Most of the time, the road to startup success is not a straight line, nor a short journey. Founders can face unexpected roadblocks and then take detours, especially in Latin America. Kristen Durham, the VP of SMBs and startups at Zendesk, chatted with the founders of Get Ninjas, Madera Madera, and Silverguard in our most recent Vamos Latam Summit. They shared the obstacles seen in their long journeys as entrepreneurs, from product development to employee retention. By the way, you can already click the link in the description to pre-register for our next incredible edition of VLS. In this episode, Eduardo Leotelier, Danielle Scandian, and Marcia Neto talk about early product development and fundraising challenges, how to deal and learn from business crises, and how to attract, engage, and retain top employees. My name is Brian Reckworth, and this is Latitude Podcast. Vamos Latam.
The things that I think are true and what we really want to explore today is that the life of a founder is unique, right? And it's often hard and it's often lonely. You carry the weight of your employees, your investors, your customers, your partners, your families. You carry all of that weight on your back. And why? Because you feel compelled to build something great. And but that greatness, it doesn't come overnight and it doesn't come easily. You know, I think we all in our experiences here know very intimately that, you know, the other side of success is actually a near-death experience. And the things that, you know, make you have to really dig deep and really commit and recommit to solving the hard problems of your startup. And so the goal for our panel today for the next 30 minutes or so is to understand some of those stories, the lessons of these great founders, the challenges that they've navigated, and importantly, you know, how they got out the other side. So hopefully you'll find a few lessons. Hopefully you'll see a little bit of empathy for the challenges maybe that you're facing yourselves right now in your companies, and we'll dig in and have a bit of fun. And so with that, I'll maybe just kind of get us warmed up and ask each of you to take a couple of minutes to introduce yourself, the company, and maybe one or two metrics of where you are today in your growth journey. We'll start with you, Edu.
Okay, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here to have this conversation. I'm Eduardo Lotelier, founder of Get Ninjas. Get Ninjas is a local service marketplace where we hire plumbers, painters, photographers, private tutors. We have more than 500 different categories in 3,000 cities. I started the company in 2010, the prototype, the MVP. And then we raised our first rounds on 2011, Mona Shiz and Kazak. Then we raised a Series B round in 2013, Series A in 2013, and Series B in 2015. And in 2021, we raised a pre-IPO round, and we raised our IPO. And then we are now learning by how to be a public company in a public space in Brazil. A lot of happens in the past 2 years, and that's it.
Awesome, thanks, Daniel. You want to?
Yes, thank you for the invitation. Happy to be here to share a little bit our 14 years that we start back in 2010. We are the biggest platform ecosystem for home goods online in Brazil today. We have products, services, logistics, online, offline stores. Like Eduardo, we have been long time the first wave of investments in Brazil, EVC. So we bootstrapped the company from 2009 until 2012. When we got the first round of investment, the size of the rounds was much smaller than we are today. But it was a really good to create a mindset of a company that didn't need a very intensive use of capital. So the rounds was more about opportunity and new things that we are building. Today we did 5 rounds, and today we have around 11 investors, since VCs, family office, growth equity, and crossover funds.
Wonderful, thank you. And Marcia, please.
So I'm Marcia. I'm presently CEO and co-founder of Silverguard, but I have been working for the last 20 years with technology and digital growth. I consider that I started to be an entrepreneur when I became a partner at Minha Vida in 2011. It was a bootstrap business that we sold in 2017. And in 2018, I co-founded with Daniel and Julia Petty Salvi, which was a great journey. And we are at Salvi at a Series B. We have Kazek and huge Astella, Canary, and huge funds. And when the company became more beauty than tech, I was responsible for tech. I took a hard decision to leave the operations and join the board of the company. And I took the last year to a personal discovery and found a huge pain, protection pain in Brazil. And I co-founded Silverguard at the beginning of this year. So I think I'm in a cycle. I came from a Series B company to start everything again since March with Silverguard. And we just read our pre-seed with Astella. And led to it, and now trying to prove product market fit. So everything again. So I think it's a story of beginning.
That's great. I think one of the important things about this panel, like you heard it, Marcia, your kind of third time founder, but especially your first company was a long period of time. Daniel, Edu, you're a decade in or more. It's your company. So not only when we talk about the myth of overnight success, you know, there's one part of the myth that is, you know, success is beautiful all the time, but there's the other part, which is that it's overnight. And I think you all really demonstrate that you have to be in it for the long haul. And it's you know, it's probably going to take 10 or more years to build a big, sustainable, durable company. But let's go back, you know, to the earlier times, and let's maybe start with fundraising, because I think one of the myths is that there's always money available for a good company. And while that may be true in part, it can be very difficult to actually get to that money. And Daniel, I know that in your early days, you mentioned you bootstrapped for a long time, and it took a while to raise that first round. And even after you raised external capital, the relationship with your investors wasn't always, you know, beautiful and obvious, and the way they were thinking about investing in the company, it changed over time. And maybe you can talk a little bit about those early experiences with the board and fundraising to keep the business going.
Yes, it was a long journey. I think, first of all, I found the company with my brother, a family business. And then Robson came after we had the first round. So I think the moment that the governance changed completely, right? You have auditing, you have board meetings, and you have, you know, a lot of people that you need to talk about it and about the business, about the challenges. For me, it was really amazing, because that was my intention, to have amazing people that had more experience than myself to help me and guide me for the right direction. And I had the really lucky to have one of the most important VCs, and in specific the persons in my board. I have Erna that was here and many others that is guiding us since 2012. Of course, this is the beauty to have these investors. But of course, you have a lot of pressure as well. So when you don't deliver it, or sometimes you promise and you miss. And you had, of course, back in 2015, We burned a lot of money because we tried to scale, and it was very difficult to raise capital. But there's no many. The ecosystem was not that we have today, and we had to do the second round with the internal investors, and then we face a board meeting that the investors said that we're not going to put more money into the company. We need to really, you know, get profitability and start to burn money. And all, that was a really important lesson that we took. We had this 90 days plan working 24/7 to recover the company. And that was important for us to get this mindset for the next, you know, 10 years as well. I feel that I have many colleagues that have sometimes very hard time with the board. So I feel that for lucky, or sometimes we choose the right investors, and I'm really happy. I think that I feel the support of them in many ways, and we feel comfortable, or, you know, in terms of, you know, doing the investments and take the time that we need to build a nice company. Amazing
company. So. That's great. But when they told you in that board meeting, no more cash, fix it in 90 days, what was your reaction?
Well, first of all, I remember that Robson, myself, and Marcelo, and other C-level, I think we were like in shock, mm-hmm. first of all. And then I remember Robson went out of the office, and then I went to understand, you know, what happened with him, and he was... sitting in the gas station, looked to nowhere. And I said, oh man, I need to take care of these guys and let's do some supportive approach here. And but it was like for 30 minutes. Then we go back, let's go back to work. So I think that resilience, you know, got us much stronger for, you know, this compound, you know, this time. And now we look back and we have, you know, some tell this story to employees also to understand that it was not like today, and we had these tough times and we learned a lot. So it was a very stressful. Actually, I had to take loans myself, my name, mm-hmm. for, you know, to get this bridge. I took some millions in my name. And I said, okay, let's, you know, it's all in. So
Yeah. I would never discount the number of startups that were built on the back of the founder's personal credit card and bridged in that time. But that's, you know, I think, again, that's the unique kind of conviction that a founder can have, but really has to have, right? Because you've got everything invested in this company, whereas, you know, maybe an employee can find another job, an investor has a portfolio of companies they're working with, but it's got to be all in when you're the founder. Another area that I know I see a lot, and it came up when we were talking, where this, you know, the beautiful stories kind of fall apart is when it comes to product market fit and finding our way in terms of what does the customer really want and how are we going to deliver it. I want to maybe start with you, Edu. I know that you've made some recent shifts, but actually especially with COVID and going to digital, but earlier in the company too, I think you took you a little while to find your way in terms of what Ninjas was really there to solve, and maybe you can share a story from that time.
So when I started the company in 2011, it was me, and I hired some bunch of people, mostly engineers, and we started to build the product. And we thought that, okay, we are smart guys, we have great, good, not so great grades, but in university, but at least we graduate, and okay. And then we start to work in the product for 1 year, and we didn't talk to a single user. And suddenly, we need to do to fix something in our office, and we use GetNinjas, And the contractor kept saying that, oh, I can't deliver you a code without seeing the place. Oh no, it's online, it's digital, it's okay, it's get ninjas, that's it. And after a while, he gave a code. And then suddenly, he showed up at the office and said, okay, I can't do this wall here because otherwise the air conditioner will not be in this room. We'll be like, we're gonna build a sauna here because there will be no ventilation at all. And they realized that, okay, we are three engineers, computer engineer, but still engineers. And we couldn't figure out how to do a simple task. And realized that, okay, now we have to list our users, the contractors, the painters, the plumbers. They really know how to solve these everyday problems because they're doing this every day. And then we pivot the product. We last 1 year. And we didn't have too much capital at that time. So maybe 2 months, something, working overnight, we grow the product maybe 10 times just because of these fixes that we did on the product. And of course, now I think everyone hears know that you have to list the users, you have to link Startup Playbook, you have many books and many lectures and many people. But back in 2011, there is no, it was difficult for us to access this knowledge. I didn't have any friend that is an entrepreneur, so I have to do the by doing. And we almost lose the company in that period. Thanks God that we had to use our product. And of course, you obviously, you have a product, you have to use, but it was not obviously 10 years ago for us. So thanks God that we had to use our own product and you couldn't see the failure that we had back then.
Yeah, I think sometimes when you're a builder, you know, by trade, when you're an engineer by trade, like you think about the product, you can get so focused and sometimes myopic and in love with this thing that you're building, but without, you know, that step of validation, without that step of, you know, maybe even sometimes using the product, you can be taken down a path and you can continue down that path for a very long time and in a way that potentially is going to be very expensive.
Yeah, I think you have to think that you are smart, but not too smart.
Okay.
So you have to listen and to sometimes admit, okay, we made a mistake here. Let's correct. Let's do it.
Yeah. And so I would assume that kind of after that learning, and it sounds like, you know, your process today when you're thinking about developing product, releasing new features, like how much is the user a part of that?
We don't code anything before talk to users, before do some prototypes and tests. And when you launch, of course, we launch small. So now we follow all these principles, guidelines to know that we what we're building is the thing that the users want. Not just what they say that it was, but we try to test if they really want what they're building. But so that's really, now it's really part of our process. And of course, this changed the whole game.
Marcia, I think you had a somewhat similar experience, but interesting that, you know, not only a belief that you needed to go out and build this product, but also like maybe the vision was a little bit clouded by foreign benchmarks or external benchmarks that you thought you needed to bring into your company and influence the road ahead. Maybe you can kind of talk about how product market fit or, you know, investors, outside influences
yes,
create some challenges.
Yeah.
Early on.
At Minha Vida, I don't know if everybody knows Minha Vida. Minha Vida was the largest health portal in Brazil at that time. And we are a bootstrap business. And then we saw a movement in US of ZocDoc. There was a listing for doctors in US, very successful. And since we were a publisher, makes sense, we moved to listicle. And we let's raise money. It was the first time that Minha Vida raised money because it was a bootstrap business and we did the business plan. We talked to lots of investors and we got the money. And when we brought the model, the same model of US to Brazil, it was a completely failure. So we had the team hired. It was a little bit people intensive, the model. And you had to, we were a small company, almost 100 people. We had to fire 30% of the people. And we had to deal with the reconstruction of the culture. It was a hard time. But what we learned from there is that sometimes you get excited. Look, there's this US benchmark and let's bring to Brazil. We also didn't talk to many people, many doctors, because the payer was the doctor. That's what the difference here in Brazil and US, because it's common US doctors pay for our exposures, and here in Brazil, no, I can't, and this kind of thing. So the learn, I think, is that. So be careful, mainly in the health business. We have some inspirations in US and other countries, and we have payers and regulatory here very different from US. But it was a toughest learning that sometimes you get excited with US benchmarks and it's going to work here, and no, it didn't work. And it was something there. I remember it took like 1 year to recover the culture of the company, because of the other departments, like, look, they cut to 30% of people, but it was necessary because you had to move. But I learned with my partner, Daniel, that we had to move fast. So I think the good things that, no, the Excel didn't work, like the folks not working. Let's move fast. And yeah, that's, I think the learning is that, Christine.
Yeah, this is an interesting point. And I'd love to hear from any of you kind of, do you think over time, the lessons you're learning, are you getting faster? Are you getting better at like seeing the big problem, seeing the warning sign and reacting? Because I think sometimes, you know, the first big crisis, it takes us a little bit of time to realize we're in a crisis. And then once we do, it takes us a little bit of time to build the plan. And then it takes us time to build the action. Has that been a change for you over time as founders, where, you know, the speed to see a problem and react has changed, or are you still getting surprised? Are you still getting sort of the same hits today in your business as you did 5 or 10 years ago?
Yeah, maybe. So I think that you have to. We build a business, first of all, around a very asset-light model that we felt that we could be much more flexible than our competitors. And we had this vision, and then we start to build the products around that vision. So we had the first dropshipping model in Brazil that connects suppliers and customers without zero inventory. And it was very important for us as a beginner to have a very good price compared to the guys that were there for 40 years, right? So we eliminate the steps until the final consumer. And we had to test a lot of things to implement this tool in Brazil. Very similar that we tried to implement in the US model, Wayfair and Bill.com to apply this to Brazil. But also we had to understand all the complexity of the fiscal and all the things to get the product we had in the back in 2016. And we had to experiment many ways to make this happen in Brazil that many other e-commerce didn't try and didn't find the solution. And we had to experiment a lot. But over time, I think that we believe that all the pain that you have, trying to make new products, you need to have a lot of reflection what that went well or not, because you're not going to learn to try. It doesn't matter if you're going to try, but you don't have the direction or the vector where you want to go, or the objective. So I think for us to test now has more an object of upfront and working backwards from the customer to have a more successful outcome and better quality of the testing as well.
Have you ever in the journey, so I think we kind of talked about challenges of raising finance, finding product market fit, like understanding what's going to work in your market, you know, that may be unique and different from the US. I think another area early on where sometimes we can be misled or take too much comfort is that our customers, you know, if they've bought, if they've purchased, they're using the product, they'll stay forever and they'll stay happy. And sometimes, you know, the investments that we have to make to be competitive, but importantly, to maintain the trust that we have with them, which can be very fragile. I think sometimes, my company, we deal in customer support. So, you know, we watch just how fragile this trust would be. On the customer front, and I know, Marcia, you went through some of these hard times in particular where maybe you had to face down your customer in a very challenging scenario and not sure how you're going to come out the other side. Could you tell that story about the product recall that you went through?
Yeah. Salvi was a great success brand since the beginning, but our third product, we had to make a recall. I don't know if everybody knows, but it was like we just have received the fund from Series A, and we're building a brand through trust and I love brand. It was a hard time to have a recall on our third product. I think we did great with the recall. We returned the money of everybody. But when you look from the entrepreneur perspective, I was 8 months pregnant with a huge belly of my second son. And it was a hard time. When I was pressing, I remember I was telling Christian, I pressed the button of the email that alerted all the base, look, we're doing a recall, your money is refunded. And I can still remember today. So I think we did great. The best recall we could made. I think Salve's recall should be studied because in the industry, nobody would make that recall. It was a tough decision, but fortunately we had the money to make the recall for refunded. But we learned a lot of the operations. We improved a lot of things. It wasn't our responsibility because it was of the outsourcing company that produced at that time our products, but it's a co-responsibility that we choose that guy. But in the personal life, that's the kind of thing that nobody knows when they're doing. No, there's a recall on the brand, but in the personal life, it's a terrible moment because you're like preparing to leave to give birth and you're doing a recall. So it's sometimes the myths or the undercover stories that nobody talks. So just share with you, but it was a very tough moment and took some time to 6 months silent in the media, not work with influencers and no money entering the company and breastfeeding a child. So it was a tough time, but we took out, we leave this scene, I think, more with more process. I think the recall at Salvi showed that I think move ahead 4 years in the company's processes and talents that we brought to the company, but it was a hard time, a personal right time and a hard time for the company too. So just recalls can happen when you have a physical product.
Yeah. I think the courage that it took to get to the point to send that email, I can't imagine how much debate was there within the company between you and your co-founder of, are we going to do this? How are we going to do that? Give us a little bit more color.
It took, we since Salve is a direct-to-consumer company, it was very fast when we noticed that something was happening in the product. So it took like 2 days after the first package started pumping and we entered the war room and let's see if the size of the problem, if it's all products, it's just one. And in 1 week, we took the decision, this hard decision, to return the money without people needing to give back the product. Because sometimes you do a recall, I send me back and I send you the money. No, everybody. And we have 70% with credit cards, so we could just press the button and return all the money. And 30% was in boletos here in Brazil at that time. So people and my CX team talked to everybody, give me your account, I'm going to give back the money. Don't use this product, please. But at the end, it was a successful moment, but a hard moment in the personal life. So it's tough stuff that happens when you're a woman, an entrepreneur. Yeah.
And these things don't happen in private and they don't happen quietly, right? All of our customers, they have social media. They have a million ways to complain about a thing that maybe we do wrong as a company. And so the stakes are very high oftentimes when a big decision like that has to be made. I know that the first major price increase that we did at Zendesk, I think we were only 3 or 4 years at the time. We had users on the platform, you know, they were loving it. They were very engaged. We had released a ton of feature functionality. And so we said, hey, they should be willing to pay for the value we've delivered. But we made the mistake of not telling them before. And I've got to tell you, it did not take very long to realize that that was a mistake, that the bills, that their bill changed month over month. And so many folks took to Twitter overnight. And then we were, you know, we were at a moment where, you know, we thought we were making a choice that was good for the company, right for the company. I think it was, but, you know, the execution of that idea, we just really missed the mark. And anytime that we do a price increase now, it's not only a long, hotly debated process within the company, but we give just as much time with the customers to get used to what's coming, make sure they understand the value and pave that path. But our founder had an I'm sorry post-it on his forehead and was on the cover of TechCrunch when that happened. I know we don't have a whole lot of time. I do want to make sure that we touch on a little bit of the leadership side, the human side, and importantly, the team that you have to build when you're a founder. And I think, you know, as we said before, the founder is kind of first and last with the company through up and down. I'd love for you guys to talk about maybe some of your experience in building that team early on and you know, maybe challenges that you faced, whether that's in hiring or retaining your teams, kind of, you know, if things are going well, if they're going challenging, like how have you faced the need to keep people engaged?
So back in 2011, it was really hard to convince someone to leave a good job and to join any startup. Nobody knows what the startup is, maybe Startup Brazil, Techie Brazil. And so that's a challenge. And in 2015, 2016, everyone knows what was a startup. Everyone wants to join a startup, but there are many startups hiring. And that was really, it was really competitive to hire great people. And then the crisis. So every year, there's a different challenge to hire people. So at the end of the day, you should try to differentiate yourself, sell the vision, treat your employees, your future employees, like investors of the company. Say, okay, we are here. If you work, we're going to end there. Because everyone wants to join the winning side, the winning team. So everyone wants to join the startup that is going to win. So, and of course, you have some mechanisms, stock options, salary to compensate. But at the end of the day, I have to make sure that the team believe in your vision. And as time goes by, you improve your culture, you improve your process, you make your vision clear for everyone. And things get a little bit easier, but I think it's the biggest challenge today. It was the biggest challenge 10 years ago, hire great people?
Yeah, I think two different time, right? In the beginning, of course, it was very difficult to hire somebody for a great company or a big company. So I think we focus on the young and employees. So a lot of interns, people that really believe in our dream and etc. So we had this combination of having people that we got that had experience and people and also interns come from the university to really believe and build with us, especially the first 3 years that we didn't get any money from investors. And then we had the first investment, and then we start to hire headhunter to bring some executives to help us in the journey. Then we had a lot of big mistakes because, you know, was completely different profile, people that were looking to the short term instead of the long term. The moment of the entrepreneur normally is not the same moment of some executives. So we work for 20 hours a day and we want people to work the same. Now we cannot do that anymore, all in the beginning. And I think now, then we have this crazy moment that this huge salaries, everybody's hiring everybody because of the 2020, 2021 moment. And then very tough. And now I think that for us, it's very clear the type of people that we want to work, not missionary instead of mercenaries. We want people for the 5-10 years long term. People that really, have the same moment that we are. I still have 96% of my assets in Madeira stock. So I'm still building for the long term and I want people to believe in that. And most important, we also codify our values and we put in the paper our leadership principles. And now we hire everybody that has the same culture or very similar culture that now is working really, really, really better. Because back in 2021, we are new people, hire new people. It was really crazy. It has no processes to guarantee the quality. And we learn a lot about that. And now we have a very strong and process that we feel that going to get us for the next 10, 15 years.
That's fantastic. I think that's all the time we have today. And like I told these guys earlier, and could sit here for hours and hours, I think, learning from you. Hopefully you all got a little bit of a taste of, whether it is team and culture and people, whether it's, fundraising, product, customers, these challenges that you're going to face as an entrepreneur, building for the long term, they're going to come. They're going to hit you from all sides. And it's really, I think two things that it sounds like become really important in those moments of crisis and in those moments where you're really going to define the opportunity for success or not. One, it's being active and thinking openly and really taking all the inputs that you need to make the decision for how to go forward. And two, it's ensuring that, that lesson from that moment isn't wasted and that you use it to inform how you're building the company better, the next day and the day and the day after that. But again,
I think 30 seconds. I want to agree with Fernand that he was the first speaker. People combine the moment. I think that if you build for many years, you're going to understand that sometimes you're going to find something in the future that we don't know yet, mm-hmm. but you need to survive until there. So you need to try to survive as much as you can, like this infinite game, and then you have more time to learn and to fix the problems.
Perfect. Yeah, couldn't say it better myself. Well, please, everyone, join me in thanking Marcia, Danielle, Edu, for joining us today. Really wonderful to hear your stories, guys. And looking forward to watching your continued success, but knowing that if it looks beautiful on the outside, you're fighting some big battles internally. So thank you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Latitude Podcast. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast for more talks with great founders and investors. I'm your host, Brian Reckworth. Vamos Latam. See you next week.